someplace there's got to be a place where people are free to discuss what they know and what they don't know and to find out what they can.
Radioactive Waves is presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Together, we will explore all things atomic, nuclear, and radioactive, along with some interesting surprises from our museum's collections and connections.
Hello! Welcome to the podcast. My name is Anna Part, and today I am here with my lovely co-host, David Gibson. How you doing, David?
I am doing wonderful. I appreciate the lovely. I don't know about that, but thank you, Anna. It's good to see you, and it's good to talk to you here on the podcast.
I always have a lovely time recording, so.
Yes, definitely. I look forward to getting a moment to chat with you and to talk about whatever crazy thing that you've pulled from the museum archives for us.
Yeah, and especially this month, we are actually recording early because I am going to be gone. I'm going to be out of the office for quite some time.
Where are you going?
I'm going to the UK.
Woohoo!
Yeah, I'm really excited. I did my master's degree over there, and during that time, I met a very good friend of mine who she gave birth to a bouncing baby boy in January.
Congratulations!
And I am his godmother.
Oh,
so
really? Oh, that's cool.
I need to go meet him because he's growing very fast, and I would like to meet him before he goes off to college. So.
For sure. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, especially being the godmother.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I'm super excited. And this actually coincides with an event that the museum is doing. It's a virtual event that I organized. That when I organized it, I didn't know that I was going to be in the UK.
Okay.
But it's actually a collaborative event with Bletchley Park, which is basically, it's where the secret operation in the UK to break the Enigma code was happening.
Awesome.
This is where Alan Turing did his work during World War II. And it's kind of a similar vibe, I would say, to Los Alamos.
Okay.
In the way that there's this community of scientists as well as like support roles. Basically, it's a little city happening in secret.
Oh, really? In the UK?
Yeah. And so there are some differences. Like, obviously, Los
the
Alamos.
Well,
yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes, also the accent. You know, there's enough similarities that when I visited there in like 2018, walking around, I just was like, it was like Los Alamos.
Oh, really?
It's just like Los Alamos. Oh, wow. Similar to Los Alamos.
Okay.
So people didn't like live there, but, you know, it had the same. And they knew that, oh, Bletchley Park, it's like secret versus most
not
people.
Not even knowing about Los Alamos existing.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So, but yeah, so we have organized an event for September 18th.
Okay.
So hopefully you guys can check that out. Go to our website and under events, you can, it's free for members.
Okay.
So if you're an Atomic History Patron member, you can come attend this for free.
And thank you, Atomic History Patron members, mm-hmm. for helping bring this podcast to life.
Absolutely.
Now, when you say we're putting on this event, you don't mean you and I, you mean the museum in general is putting on, but you put together this event for the museum.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's actually a like three-way collaboration.
Okay.
Because we also have esteemed historian Alan Carr, Los Alamos Labs official historian,
okay.
Alan Carr, and he's actually going to be collaborating with Bletchley Park's official historian, David Kenyon, and they're just going to, basically, we're going to have 45 minutes of talking about how these two institutions are similar and how they're different and how secrecy was handled during World War II by these two very different governments with very different amounts of resources and funding. And I think that's going to be really, really interesting.
Oh, that'd be super interesting, to just find out You know, while we're finding out, we are still finding out things that are now becoming declassified about just a few miles north of us here in Los Alamos, and to find out what it was like across the world. You know, like you say, things that were close, you know, as far as the ideas and the mentality of these secret little labs and things. Yeah. That's pretty awesome. That's cool.
And the kind of communities that they built. I don't know. I'm very excited for it. I think it's going to be great. So please check out our website at nuclearmuseum.org under the events tab. And if you're not a member, it's $10. But yeah, please come along. I think it should be really fun and interesting. And I'm really excited that I'm going to be there, even though it's a virtual event.
Right.
And I'm going to be doing it from like the house I'm staying in.
That's awesome.
Me and my friend are going to go visit and take some pictures and check it out for you guys so that, you know, museum people can get an inside scoop.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
And so when they're listening to this podcast, you're actually right now in the UK. Now, very moment as we're recording it, you're across the table from me here in Albuquerque. But when this releases, you will already be in the UK.
Hopefully.
So is the plan. Yeah. Welcome to 2021.
Yes.
Yeah. So is the plan.
So, yeah. So because of all this, I thought that it would be a really great idea to have today's episode be about the British nuclear program, and specifically about how there was a big group of scientists from the UK that came and actually helped in Los Alamos and helped out the Manhattan Project.
Okay.
So today we're going to be talking about the British mission.
See, I think this is amazing. This is very interesting for me personally. I have very, very little knowledge. I recognize some of the characters. And by characters, I don't mean someone that played someone else. But no, it's spies and things like that. But I recognize some of the names that you're referring, but I really know very, very little about this. So I'm excited to hear what you've got put together for us for this British nuclear program.
Well, and I would like to additionally thank Alan Carr, not just for being willing to do this event later this week. Well, this time, podcast time, whatever.
sure.
Thank you.
When you hear this, yeah.
Yes. But also, he had a PowerPoint that he allowed me to access through our archives, and this is how I got a lot of the information. It was the best source that I found. Wikipedia was fine, you know, our AHF is fine. It gives you the basic information, the basic facts, but this kind of helped me organize a lot. So thank you, Alan Carr. I appreciate it.
And I think that's neat to mention. I know we spoke about last time about your the archives and things. That's not always necessarily a physical object. Sometimes those archives are something that is information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a pretty big digital archive as well as a physical one. So, So a little bit of basic information. During World War II, the British government was also working towards an atomic bomb. There were two immigrant scientists who, in March of 1940, Otto Frisch and Rudolf Peierls, I have looked up how to pronounce this. It is P-E-I-E-R-L-S.
But we both heard it. That was how it was pronounced.
Peierls.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Frisch and Peierls were working at the University of Birmingham when they calculated the exact, close to the exact mass that you would need of a pure uranium-235 sphere. They calculated that to reach that critical mass, it would really actually only take like 1 to 10 kilograms, which is like 2-ish pounds to 22 pounds. So that's really not a lot of material. And then it would explode with something like a thousands of tons of dynamite equivalent. So they published this memorandum in 1940. And this actually was what prompted Britain to start their atomic bomb project, which, and I didn't know this, was called tube alloys.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. So in the same way that, like, the Manhattan Project has nothing to do with the big bomb project.
Like, yeah, big yeah. bombs and things like that. They called it tube alloys. Yeah. Well, that would make sense. I mean, it sounds scientific mm-hmm. to someone who doesn't know, and you're working with material science, mm-hmm. and you'd say, okay, tube alloys, I can understand that, especially when you are looking at something of how much is the mass of this, or, you know,
exactly. we need.
Yeah, tube alloys.
And initially, tube alloys was much larger than the American program and had a lot more funding and all of this. But, of course, this was far before 1940. This was way before the Americans got into the Second World War. And, you know, as soon as the U.S. entered the war, the Manhattan Project just bloomed. It
blew up.
Yeah.
I had to. Sorry.
Did you hear the pause where I didn't notice the pun and then I did?
Yeah, I had to. I apologize.
It's
yes.
okay. It's okay. It's good. I like puns. But yeah, so, and because of this, it became clear to the British government by 1942 that their bomb project was not, it was not up to speed. It was not going as well as the American. It was just, honestly, they didn't have the same resources. They're on the front line. They've been fighting this war for years already. Right. And the Americans are just rolling up with all of their resources. So in July of 1943, Churchill personally negotiated a deal called the Quebec Agreement. And this was signed by both governments in Canada, which at this time Canada was still part of the British Empire.
Okay.
So Canadians were still British citizens. And both of the governments agreed to this, to the Quebec Agreement, on the 19th of August, 1943. And immediately after this, the British begin to arrive. And the journey, there's a oral history that I have that I'll put in a little clip here in a minute, or I'll have David put in a little clip.
Okay.
That he talks about the journey. This man is, Anthony French.
Okay.
And he talks about the just absolutely wild journey that they had to take to get from, well, I imagine he was coming from Cambridge. So it's Cambridge to London, London to Ireland, Ireland to New York, New York to, I think he said Chesapeake Bay out west.
So the planes, trains, and automobiles of it all. Yes.
Yes. Yes. So here's Anthony French talking a little bit about that.
Do you remember your actual physical leaving of England? How did you get from England to...
Well, it was very exciting. I certainly do remember it because it was my first flight.
Ah.
And we went down to Bournemouth and got on a flying boat in Poole Harbour down in near Bournemouth, and then were flown to the Shannon Estuary, and then a 17-hour trip across to Gander, and then from there a flight down to Chesapeake Bay, which was our first sight of the USA.
Uh-huh. And from there, train to...
And then, I was trying to remember whether we actually stayed a night in Washington. I know we were put on a train and went up to Washington, and I think it may be that that very same night we got on a train for Chicago and had a few hours in Chicago, and then got onto the California Limited and had two more nights, I suppose it was, on the train to go to Laney.
Well, that is quite the journey.
I'm very glad that I just have a 10-hour flight.
Right, because you are now, you know, as we said, you are, when you're hearing this, you're in the UK. But
yes,
as of right now.
Yes, I am very jet-lagged on my friend's couch.
But as of right now, you're looking forward to that flight.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I'm very grateful that it is not quite so many connections.
I'm sure.
Just the one. So. Yeah. But yeah, so several of these British citizens who work in the Manhattan Project.
Mm-hmm.
They went to several of the Manhattan Project sites. Like, there were a couple people at Chicago. I think there might have been a couple people at Oak Ridge. But the largest number of them were sent to Los Alamos. And they were originally led by Sir James Chadwick. But this soon changed, and the position was actually transferred. Most of these people are coming from, in Britain, they're coming from the educational institutions.
Okay.
And not so much from the government, which is a little bit different than the way that our program was run. And, you know, the British program was actually much stronger theoretically. Their theories were much stronger, and
because it came from academia rather than, or
that's what they were focusing on.
Based in academia rather than exactly. in the government part of it. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And so they needed this like theoretical basis to help physically build the stuff that the Americans were working on. And yeah, so they went to like all the different sites, but 24 of them, that's the biggest chunk, came to Los Alamos. But soon after this, the position was actually transferred to Piles.
Yes.
And Chadwick actually ended up remaining in D.C. to work as kind of like liaison. Of these 24 men, 14 of them were actually from Britain. One was from Canada, which, like I said before, still a British citizen.
Was part of, yeah.
But there was actually quite a few immigrants, people who had been moving around in Europe, you know, with the destabilization that fascism was causing there. They kind of were trying to get to a safer place. And a lot of them went to the UK. So that meant that there were two scientists from Denmark, one from Switzerland. There was one Russian. There were two Germans, which we will circle back around to that in a minute. There was one Czechoslovakian and one from Poland.
So Los Alamos, this super secret, you couldn't have your in-laws mm-hmm. over to visit you.
Mm-hmm.
Said, okay, well, we're going to allow these people coming from the UK, but that are originating from all over the globe.
Yeah.
And,
you know, it is a very ally-heavy
right.
group.
The group is.
But
these are a lot of separate governments mm-hmm. that a lot of these folks are coming from. That does sound like an interesting mix.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously, you know, we weren't quite at the Cold War stage of things, but
right.
we were not freely helping the Russians in the way that we had, you know, this, as it's called, the special relationship.
Right.
So deemed by Thatcher that we have today. And yet.
We allowed them on our super secret.
Exactly.
Labs there. Okay.
Exactly. So, yeah, Anthony French talks a lot about the kind of the difference. There's a lot of, you'll find a lot of accounts of unmarried GIs in the Manhattan Project complaining about how bad the conditions were and how it was like not very nice, all of this. And, Anthony French also talks a little bit about this
okay.
and how it's, yeah, here, we'll let him talk.
Before getting married, I was living in a dormitory down off the hill somewhat near one of the army cafeterias, but within easy walking distance to Fuller Lodge, and I did all my eating in Fuller Lodge, as I recall. Of course, there were things that were very unpleasant, especially for the families, about the material conditions of living.
Uh-huh.
I personally found it all very stimulating. My dorm room didn't compare with the very excellent rooms I'd had at Cambridge. It's amazing to think back to those days, where as an undergraduate, I had two separate rooms, a bedroom and a living room.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all very, very comfortable. But when it came to things like food, the contrast was absolutely incredible.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. To come from Britain in the middle of the war with its blackout and its food rationing, to me, America was just a land of milk and honey.
So, yeah. So I find it really interesting. That's another, you know, example of how maybe the American West was a little bit wilder, maybe
but
not
we
as
have better food.
Comfortable, yes, but we have all these resources.
Right, right.
We can feed our people in a much tastier way than even Cambridge University could at this point in the war. So, yeah, pretty interesting. And of course, all of this changed when people got married. You would get a whole house instead of just a dormitory, and yeah.
Which is something that you can hear if you listen back in our podcast when we were speaking to Hal Bell, who was married. And yeah, the differences that he, you know, mentions there in the podcast when he was speaking to us about living at, you know, during the Manhattan Project and in these labs that, there was a definite step up if you were living the married life there rather than the single life.
Well, and I think particularly in Oak Ridge, too, because Oak Ridge had a little bit more space.
Right, right.
So I can, like, say a little bit about who contributed what when they were over here. So of the British mission, these scientists, Pales, Furch, Brester, and Plasek.
That was a mouthful, yes.
Yeah. Those international names, us little Americans have a little bit of trouble with them.
Sure.
But these men were the group leaders, and they were making sure that everybody was doing what they were supposed to and where they were supposed to be. Piles and a man named Fuchs, F-U-C-H-S, played critical roles in the hydrodynamics group. So they, like, really helped in that department. Titterton designed many of the electronic control and diagnostic systems for the implosion program, which that is actually today what the museum is kind of, that's like the most dangerous thing. Because a lot of those things are declassified, but are export controlled. So those are the kind All of right. information that we have access to, but that we might not be able to share.
To display, because it is, yeah.
So it's interesting.
So you mean we didn't want another country to have it, but we sent we allowed all these people
to come in and do this work for
countries
us.
Okay, I don't know about that. Yeah, okay, anyway, right.
Not quite. But the fact that, like,
yeah.
a British citizen was the one who did this, like, really sensitive stuff is that's really important. Tuck, he was instrumental in developing the implosion lens system. Taylor predicted turbulence that was witnessed at the Trinity test. He actually, I found this really interesting. He knew that there would be, like, instability problems with the development of Fat Man. And he was actually able to contribute, like, his work that was being done on hydrodynamics to solving this problem. His work actually led to, like, a new design to minimize the like, instability in the atomic bomb. The Rayleigh-Taylor instability is it's like a it's named after him, obviously. It's an instability between an interface of two fluids with densities. So, you know, like, when you I'm sure that as Mr. Dave, you've done plenty of, you know, density experiments. And yeah, the interference, the, like, swirling between
are going to act differently. And so when you've got them, you know, back to back or packed together, you're going to have an instability. If something is able to move, you know, with a lot less viscosity and able to move freely, and the other one is tied up or, you know, a lot more chemically bound, then you are going to have an instability problem there. So you are going to have turbulence. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so, so Taylor was actually able to predict this, and he knew that this could cause some really some issues with the bomb because of how hot it was going to be expanding, mm-hmm. and just the temperature of the air around it.
Well, and that's what gives us that nice, big, beautiful mushroom cloud that we call it, that we see, is that the air around it is not able to move as quickly as this superheated air pushing straight up and then giving us those nice little swirls that we see, that turbulence, those vortices, yeah. from that mushroom, from that explosion.
Exactly. So he was able to actually like say like, hey, we need to expect this turbulence.
Really? That's awesome.
So that we can, you know, so that we stay safe. And he advised the Los Alamos theorists to be a little bit more cautious. And in the summer of 1944, part of the design was changed. Something called the temper sphere was redesigned on his recommendation. Hmm. So I think that's really interesting. He was also one of the 10 people to officially witness the Trinity test. Groves handpicked him. So I think that's very interesting. Such a small group of people. And again, a British citizen is included,
right, was
because
part
of
that.
His contributions. Right. Yeah.
Well, and I think that a lot of that stems from them looking at it as at a, you know, at an academic level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to view things differently, and they are going to be able to
add
look
perspective.
At a different, yeah, exactly, through a different and no, you know, pun intended on the other one, but a different lens. They are going
yeah.
to be able to say, oh, okay, well, let's take this to a you know, a broader place, because we're not so focused in on what they're already building.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and additionally, Penny measured the blast and served on the target committee. So we had a lot of British folks making sure that this test was done safely, which,
sure.
well, depending on who you ask, it was done safely.
Yeah.
Because they didn't know what they were dealing
with. That's what I was saying. When you have this many variables, when you have
mm-hmm.
this many, I mean, they didn't know if, okay, when we did this, this is going to start a chain reaction that will not end.
Yeah.
You know, there were
they
so
thought
many
that they
things.
Were, the atmosphere was going to
right. yeah,
set
it was
on fire.
Going to combust. Yeah,
yeah.
We're now going to blow up Earth. Yeah, they really, there were a lot of things that they did not know. And it was a matter of that, okay, well, is the, you know, is the science worth it at this point?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, something else that they did not know was that they had a spy in their midst.
Now, can I interject? Now, we're, you know, we're adults here, but the,
yes.
And I say that because I'm going to now say something very immature. The the name of this individual, I teach classes, and
yes.
and if you are looking, it is spelled F-U-C-H-S.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mentioned it earlier. It's
if you're teaching junior high and high school kids, you do have to point out the proper pronunciation of this word, and you will get snickers, and it is almost a distraction. But it's worth it because it's such an interesting individual. And, you know, if you look up more about the spying and the things that had happened here that you're going to, you know, talk about here in a second. It's very much worth it. But yeah, it is. If you want to look up this individual, it is F-U-C-H-S.
Mm-hmm.
And the pronunciation will make as Fuchs. But the mm-hmm. Anytime you have a high schooler or junior high student
or,
read this.
Or me.
Yeah. Or
the
or
first
Anna
time
I
read it. Yeah.
Yeah. You are going to have a snicker or two. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Just coming from the educator side on that one.
No. And I think it's, you know, we should acknowledge it. But yeah, so this man, his name was Klaus Fuchs. He was a German born. He was born in Germany, but he was also a member of the Communist Party. His whole family was a very socialist family, and was actually very negatively affected by the rise of the Nazis. You know, socialism. National Socialist Party, right? But
right.
very much, his family was very much of the anti-fascist variety of socialism.
There you go.
There we go. Yeah. So he fled Germany in 1933, right after Hitler rose to power. So he saw early on, this is not good for me. This is not good for my family. I need to get out of here. He went to Britain, and he was a very bright young man. And in 1937, he completed his PhD at the University of Bristol. He's on this good path. In 1942, he actually became a British citizen. He has found his new home. He is getting comfortable there. He is contributing to the world of academia. He is taken all the way to the U.S. on this super top secret mission to work on this bomb. And he decides that he is going to give his notes to the communist power of the day. Right. So he starts leaking secrets to Soviet Russia.
Which even in one of those kind of things you may see on the panels here at the museum, he is a German-born
yeah.
spy,
yeah.
which is mistaken, and that is something that I mm-hmm. clarify. He is a German-born spy, but that your brain automatically goes to, okay, well, then he was working for the Nazis. Well, he was not working for the Nazis.
He was not a friend of the Nazis.
Yes, exactly. He was still working against the Nazis, even though he was a German-born spy. Yeah.
And that's why I just find this guy so interesting.
Right, that's why I said, hey, look into this guy. Yeah, because it really mm-hmm. is quite a story to this individual.
And the way that he, had to have perceived his own national identity in order to do this.
Right.
To commit treason, because mm-hmm. that's what he did.
Very much so.
Both against the British government and against the British government's closest ally.
Right.
And yet he was still very much sticking to his principles.
Right. Well,
it's just fascinating.
Yeah, because you see, and even in this context, this Manhattan Project context,
mm-hmm.
You'll see spies that did it for money.
Mm-hmm.
But this, in reading about Fuchs, a lot of it really was principle driven. It was a matter
of
this
right
is
thing.
Against Nazi Germany, which,
mm-hmm.
Is kind of a strange conundrum.
Yeah.
In the United, going against the United yeah. States. And yeah, this is a, he's a fun individual to look up.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do appreciate the German-born as spy, because you really have to take that into the whole story
mm-hmm.
rather than taking that out of context.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, I had heard about him before. Mm-hmm. I had a little bit of knowledge, but I didn't know that he was a British citizen.
Right.
That just adds a whole layer of, I don't even know. I don't know what it is, but I think it's just a fascinating
right.
version of spying that was not, it's not what you typically think of.
Right. This is not a for hire, James Bond thing.
Yeah.
This is,
or being blackmailed.
Right. Right. Exactly. This is the principles and the self, the thought process,
mm-hmm.
the mind. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was an extremely intelligent individual.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have been where he was anyway.
Yeah. And although I personally would never do this, obviously, I kind of am glad on a certain level that he did, because who would have kept the U.S. in check if the Russians didn't have some of this knowledge? Obviously, this caused the Cold War, which is not a good thing.
Right. But but that's one of those what ifs.
Exactly.
Don't know what would have happened.
Yeah.
And it really did end up leading to, being a pivotal event, or,
mm-hmm.
This information being in their hands.
Yeah.
And, that's one of those what ifs. But
mm-hmm.
it is interesting how pivotal he was in getting that information
yeah.
to Russia.
Yeah. And I mean, his work was also very valuable. He contributed to the Manhattan Project
mm-hmm.
as well. So very, very strange case of Klaus Fuchs. After the fact, Oppenheimer said that the British contribution was essential. But there was an official report that like tabulated everything, and they said that the official report said that the British mission had only accounted for about 1% of the success of the atomic bomb, which, I mean, by number of people, yeah, probably, maybe even less. Sure. The Manhattan Project was huge.
Right.
But by scientific contribution, who's to say?
Sure.
General Groves said, on the whole, the contribution of the British was helpful but not vital. But, I mean, Taylor was handpicked by Groves to be at the Trinity test, and his predictions and warnings kept the scientists, like, a bit more safe. I don't know. That seems pretty vital to me. But yeah, so a few weeks after the devastation of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you know, everybody was kind of reeling from that, both positive and negative. Mm-hmm. And the armistice meant that the British decided to throw a party. And yeah, we have some really great photographs of this party that the British wives were the ones who actually like took the lead in organizing the event. And they made sure that there was soup, steak and kidney pie, and trifle, as well as whiskey, brandy, and port wine. So
quite the party.
Yeah. Tuck wrote a play about it was like a satirical little, I don't know, like a skit almost, about security regulations and housing and the Trinity test.
Really?
And
is
like,
that something that's available anywhere?
We only have pictures.
Really?
I would love
to have seen that.
Yeah,
or find like a screenplay to the script. Yeah, that'd be awesome. Yeah, a script to that play.
I wonder if that's somewhere. Maybe up in Los Alamos I don't know. I could do some digging and see if I can find
that. Kind of interesting,
but,
yeah.
Because that could be really fun to...
No doubt.
to act out too.
Yeah.
Like
you
I said,
do
these
a radio drama of the
yes. Yeah. Oh my god, that's so funny. And the pictures of this are really funny. You know, the expressions are like super. It's almost like a pantomime.
Sure.
Like a British pantomime, mm-hmm. Melodrama sort of. Yeah, it's great. I will see if we can't get some of these pictures up on our social media so that you
sure.
guys can see. And yeah, so then that's really the end. It marks the end of the, full integrated collaboration between the US and the UK, on atomic and nuclear weapons.
Right.
And, atomic energy. So after the war, there are several British scientists that call for international control. And the Atomic Energy Act of 1946 officially prohibited any exchange of information about atomic or nuclear weapons. And so that was really, you know, that's the end of that.
Right.
Like I said, just fully,
yeah,
fully integrated collaboration. And then on August 29th of 1949, the Soviets test Joe-1. And in the early 1950s, Fuchs is arrested in Britain for espionage. So it's several, you know, it's
a while later.
About half a decade?
Right.
And a few months after that, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg are arrested. And then it wasn't actually until October of 1952 that the UK tested its first atomic bomb, which kind of shows you like how much they were behind.
Right.
And how much just throwing so much federal money at the Manhattan Project did to really
speed up that process.
Yeah. Push that forward. So I'm going to talk a little bit more just about the legacy of this collaboration, because even though it was over, you know, that this has lasting impacts beyond just the information that Fuchs gave
right.
to the Soviets.
Right.
There's, you know, the British continued to make important technical and social contributions, and they did so during the project as well. The wartime cooperation foreshadowed kind of the mutual defense agreement. And under that, the U.S. and the U.K. Have conducted dozens of full-scale and subcritical nuclear tests. So there is still this collaboration. It's just that it's not as freely given.
Okay.
It's not as open and easy. And I do think part of that is probably because the Americans felt burned by Fuchs.
Understandably so.
Yeah. Right. So... yeah, there's a few people. Mark becomes a U.S. citizen, and he actually serves as T Division leader for 25 years. Tuck becomes a U.S. citizen and spends the remainder of his career in Los Alamos. I think that a lot of these guys really liked it up there and had, you know, a really nice time, thought it was beautiful.
Well, it is pretty up there. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Fuchs was actually released after serving 9 years in prison, and he immigrated to East Germany. So what a journey from being born in Germany, right, having to flee, becoming a British citizen, then coming to America, betraying the British and the Americans for the Soviets, then being put in prison,
going to jail,
several years later, serving out your sentence, and then when you get out, there's a little pocket. Well, there's not a little pocket. There's half of Germany that is communist. And so he gets to go back home, I guess.
Yeah.
And so that's where he lives. Penny actually becomes the British Oppenheimer and gets knighted. Rotblat leaves the project early, and he actually wins a Nobel Peace Prize.
Right.
Yeah. And Pales is knighted in 1968. So, you know, these guys, except for Fuchs, go on to live really interesting and technically helpful lives. Mm-hmm. What's a better way of saying that? Academically active.
Oh, academically active. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And academically productive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, so I appreciate you putting all this one together. This is, you know, as I said, I've heard parts of this. Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard little bits and pieces. You know, I have heard of Fuchs, as we mentioned,
mm-hmm.
And some of the other names. But this story to kind of encapsulate what was going on and why they were here and what they did, I think this is awesome. I've never... heard the majority of this information. So thank you for putting this together for us.
Yeah, anytime. I thought it was really interesting too. And I also think that, yeah, it was fun. It was fun to learn about. And I think that at some point we might be able to do something about the British testing.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause, you know, I'd be happy to do like an Operation Crossroads episode for us, for the U.S. at some point. And then maybe we can do something about the British testing as well. There's some really, some interesting parallels and differences, ways that governments have dealt with how this happened and
mm-hmm.
aftermaths. And
there's a lot there.
There's a lot of history there. So, yeah, I would just like to thank our Atomic History patron members.
Definitely.
I would like to direct you all to nuclearmuseum.org. Please go check us out. We're also all over social media. And you can contact us by sending an email to info@nuclearmuseum.org. And we would be happy to have any suggestions, questions. Do you want to be interviewed?
Sure, yeah. If you've got something that's relative information, we'd love to talk to you about it. Or here, you know, Anna has got access to so many cool things. Yeah, maybe there's some topic that you would like to hear about. That'd be wonderful. And as we say, as we end all of them, thank you, Atomic History patron members. And don't forget
to wash your hands.
Radioactive Waves has been presented by the National Museum of Nuclear Science and History. Join us next time for more interviews, histories, and insights on topics like the Manhattan Project, science and pop culture, the atomic age, and the differences between nuclear fact and fiction.